One of the most anticipated IPOs of the year risks not happening at all. Plus, what's an AI phone? It is Wednesday, January 17th. Welcome to the Tech Check Podcast. I'm Deirdre Bosa with Mark Gilbert. Hello, Gilbert.
Good morning, Dee. A few topics today, but I think we should start with Samsung. It is probably the newsiest thing that happened today. It happened in just the last hour or two. Out with a new suite of phones. And we don't always talk about these Samsung launch events, but this one, they're talking about a whole new suite of AI features. Some people are calling it the first AI phone. Samsung calling it, quote, a comprehensive mobile AI experience. What do you think, Dee?
So, it was a little bit underwhelming because a lot of the features are not all that new or revolutionary, especially if you've been playing around with ChatGPT and Bard and all of these different large language model applications. But Samsung calls its blend Galaxy AI. That's sort of its umbrella term. I just watched the presentation online where it released phones and all the new features, et cetera. But I would maybe sum up that sort of AI experience that's on the phone now into five main categories. Search, there's language translation, message composition and note creation, and then photo editing and processing.
I mean, I thought the language translation maybe out of all of them was most impressive. There was one reviewer I read who used it to quickly call a restaurant in Korea and was able to make a reservation over the phone, and the phone was able to do live translation both ways from English to Korean, Korean back to English, quickly enough to have a live conversation.
Yes, and that's a great point. So let me go back. Really impressive, but not new. Like, we've kind of seen these in different presentations at Google I/O, even Apple stuff, but to see it work like this so seamlessly, that is kind of what's new here, right? If last year was the year of the AI enabler and this is the year of the AI adopter, this is a great use case. It's bringing those things that we thought were so cool and bringing them into your fingertips, onto your phone, so that they can actually be practical.
And I think that's a theme we've really talked about, which is that last year it was all of this sort of, I don't want to call it naivete, but it was kind of like this newness of like, wow, look at these large language models. And now it's kind of like, all right, well, like, show me some products. What are the products going to look like? And we're seeing that today. We're seeing some of the actual applications, which is that, you know, the products are going to look like, I don't know, what's something they announced? Like, you could circle something. It's called search by circle, and you circle something, and then it does a Google search of that image or that thing you just circled.
I thought this was the presentation was a good promotion of Google's AI, right? When we talk about the mega caps who are sort of in this race, it's Microsoft, it's Google, it's Amazon, in the cloud and application level, and then like NVIDIA at the GPU level. And I thought that this was a good endorsement because it's basically bringing all of those really cool Google AI features into the phone, because Samsung phones run on Android, and that is the operating system that's powered by Google. So 2024, and we've been talking about this, especially on our discussion of Apple's AI strategy, 2024 is the year in which AI has to prove its purpose on smartphones, those applications. And that started today with Samsung. It might not be how we end up using it. It might be some kind of iteration of this, but this is really the start. And the key development is not that these are new features necessarily. You might have seen them in different iterations, but the key development here is that the AI is mostly processed on devices, and that is different. You have chips that are powerful enough to actually do these tasks on the phone itself versus, translating or communicating with servers.
Yeah, exactly. And I think we're nerdy, so we're going to talk about those actual chips, which is, they're from Qualcomm, and it's the Snapdragon line of chips. And exactly what you said, it's sort of, you know, Qualcomm has already last year laid out that some of these features were going to be coming. But then you sort of see from the actual smartphone makers, how many of those features do they actually pick up from the chip makers? But these are, you know, these have to be sort of like the cutting edge chip, which allows the phone to be able to run these types of applications.
So it was at this Qualcomm presentation. It was called the Snapdragon Summit back in October. And that's when everyone was just jumping on the generative AI train. Every company, chip maker, et cetera, was saying, you know, we're working on this. We're going to have something. We're going to have these really like interesting AI propositions. And so back then, Qualcomm sort of emphasized its ability to run AI models and perform AI actions, both locally and in the cloud, showed off use cases for AI on smartphones. But if you look at sort of what the stock has done since then, not a whole lot, right? I think that we reached this period last year, this point last year when Wall Street said, don't tell me, show me. And this is Qualcomm's show me moment. If you look at its performance versus the other, you know, what we think of as the typically AI chip makers, that's NVIDIA, of course, that's, as we've talked about, more than tripled over the last year. But even a Broadcom, right, that a Broadcom is up nearly 100% over the last year. AMD, right, which has also been working on its own AI chip, that's up 127% year to date. Qualcomm, 14%. So this could be a really interesting opportunity for the chip rally and the case for AI chip makers to broaden to.
Yeah, and whether Qualcomm can sort of, you know, flip the narrative, right? Whether Qualcomm can kind of, you know, broadcast itself as an AI leader. I mean, I think exactly pointing to that chart, AMD being up, 224% and Qualcomm being up 14%.
No, that's NVIDIA.
Oh, sorry. I'm misreading the chart. You're showing me.
But still,
NVIDIA being up 224%, AMD being up 127%. Yeah. And then Qualcomm down at the bottom up 14. It's like, you know, you can really see a valuation reset if you're able to spread this narrative. The other piece of news we got today was that the biggest IPO of this year, it was going to be Shein. It still might be Shein. It's the Chinese fast fashion company planning an IPO here in the U.S. But then today we got this headline, China's internet police, basically its cybersecurity regulator, is reviewing, and this is always the term that we hear, they're reviewing how Shein handles data.
Right. And I was able to, Wall Street Journal had this first, but I was able to confirm with a source familiar with the situation that it is under review. And by the way, we're supposed to call Shein, fashion as a service company, not fast fashion.
Not fast fashion.
Because the business model is supposed to be more efficient. And you know, that may be the case, but of course, that's why we want that S1, or it would be an F1 in this case, an IPO prospectus, to really dive in and see how that business model works. But the company confidentially filed to go public in the US last November, now facing a security review in China. And the source I spoke to emphasized that the review is centering on its supply chain presence in the country, because remember that Shein doesn't actually sell to the Chinese. They sell outside of China, but they source within China. But it's significant because a review by the Chinese authorities could impact the planned listing in a few ways. We've seen this movie before. Remember Didi? It went public. We thought it was a successful listing, but then just days after, Beijing launched a similar probe here. Ultimately, that destroyed billions of dollars in value and led to its delisting within a year. And I guess the point, too, is that you're never quite safe if you're a Chinese company. And Beijing has shown its willingness to crack down on even its most successful companies over the last few years.
What a debacle. I had sort of forgotten about Didi. Goes public, huge sort of like, you know, publicity, this big moment. Wow, you know, Chinese ride-hailing company going public at the New York Stock Exchange. And then just boom, hit with that news that it was getting that probe, and then ultimately delisted. Just like, investors lost a lot of money with that.
Yeah. And then before Didi, it was Alibaba, right? One of the most successful, you know, tech giants to come out of China. Also got kind of the smackdown from Beijing. Different circumstances there, but just again, this idea that you never know what Beijing is going to take aim at, who's pissed off the communist government, or who hasn't shown them the right enough face or something like that.
And yeah, I think it really encapsulates that if you thought that era was over, you know, think again, right? That if the Chinese government decides to clamp down on a business, you know, especially when that business is, you know, grows too powerful and threatens to become, so large that it can't be reined in by the state reins it in.
And a lot of that happens, you know, in private, behind closed doors. So you don't necessarily know what's coming in the same way that you might have lawmakers, you know, making noise about companies they want investigated here in the U.S. because it's a communist government over there. But essentially after Didi, right, that really changed the landscape, changed investor sentiment towards Chinese companies, because all Chinese companies seeking an IPO were subject to a security review from the CAC. That's the Beijing body that looks at this, and also needed approval from the government. So you saw others, including TikTok parent ByteDance, shelve or scrap their IPO plans altogether. But maybe more importantly than the review itself, is that the fact that it's happening draws attention to Shein as a Chinese company. It has gone through great lengths to position itself as non-Chinese, moved its headquarters to Singapore, diversifying its supply chain. I was texting someone this morning in China, a source of mine, and I said, aren't they supposed to be not Chinese? And he just kind of laughed, because anyone who knows the company or knows much about the company just knows that it's a Chinese company, but except maybe its consumers, right? It has had so much success here in America with consumers that a lot of people buying stuff from the platform don't know it's Chinese. Anyone covering the company, that's a no-brainer.
I actually was looking for data on this and couldn't find good sort of reliable data on how much Shein's customers in the US know that it's Chinese at all. I mean, I think it's really tough to know, right? Because there's lots of brands that have manufacturing in China or, you know, Vietnam for that matter, and probably don't think about, you know, where that's sourced. But because it's, you know, Adidas or Nike, they think of it as like a friendlier brand. But I have no idea, and really hard to tell. But I do imagine there's a large portion of Shein's customer base in the United States that doesn't think of it that way. I mean,
right. Temu, we've talked about the sort of these Chinese companies that have had so much success here and don't necessarily need to be. Consumers don't care where they come from as long as you're offering cheap prices and efficient delivery.
Totally. It feels like sort of like a strategy from like the 90s, like these like cheap made Chinese goods flooding over into the US. Just sort of the difference is that they're going to direct to consumer, that they're these marketplaces, that they're not, you know, making them for like Eddie Bauer. Shein's group, Vice President Marcelo Claure, who is probably familiar to our audience as the former CEO of Sprint, and then he worked with SoftBank, was asked about this on our air and said it's a big misconception and called it, of course, he's at the company, but he said Shein is the most global company I've ever seen, have ever been engaged with. So he's really trying to make this point that it's not Chinese, that it's a global company. And I think that these headlines are going to make it difficult to make that argument. And it's only going to, you know, gain the attention of lawmakers here in the US who are already demanding more scrutiny before it's able to go public.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a bipartisan group of 22 Congress members last year wrote a letter to SEC Chair Gary Gensler demanding greater scrutiny before approving a US listing. But Shein was probably counting on this, right? Which is why they have Marcelo Claure coming on TV and saying that, no, it's a global company and moving their headquarters to Singapore. But as it turns out, Beijing's review could be just as tough, and it's going to be far less transparent when they do these kinds of reviews. It's a black box. You don't know how long it's going to take either. So this could really delay those plans if it doesn't derail them.
I mean, you talk about our regulators, like, right, they announce a review and everyone's sort of like, nah, who cares? Nothing's going to happen. Like a lot of times with these Chinese companies, when they announce a review, like the company does not recover. That could be a real turn. You know, I'm not saying it's going to be here, but it's definitely has the opportunity to be more than just a slap on the wrist.
Right. And then just the last point I want to make here is that this has broader implications for our IPO market at large, which has really been shut for like 2 years now, right? We did have some signs of life last fall with Arm and Instacart and Klaviyo.
Yeah.
But they haven't performed particularly well. So it wasn't like a ringing endorsement of this market. Shein could be, right? It's actually one of the biggest private companies in the world. It was last valued at $66 billion in the private market. So it's high profile, one of the most highly valued companies that's still private. Could have been a really, it may still be a very interesting IPO candidate, but this may complicate the picture a little bit. I'm not going to hold my breath because we've seen that once the Chinese government gets involved, everything is up in the air.
Can we talk about one more story? You want to do it?
Yeah.
Just quickly do one more minute. So shares of Instacart spiked today. It's up more than 8% right now, all because an analyst at Wolf Research basically wrote this note fantasizing about what would happen if Uber bought the company. And that's, you know, sometimes that's enough.
And sometimes those are the most fun notes to read. You and I were debating, do we cover this on TV today? And we said, no, we don't, because, you know, there's no actual indication or suggestion that Uber's doing it, but or Instacart would ever be open to doing this or thinking about it. But it's one of those fun storylines where every once in a while, the Apple Disney acquisition also comes up.
You know, the other one I was thinking about
is so fun to think about.
is sometimes like the, you know, Laura Martin will also write those notes about like what the value of Alphabet would be if you split it up, like what the sum of the parts is. And I think what's, you know, I don't think that anyone's actually arguing that Alphabet's about to be split up, but it does offer an alternate way of looking at the company. Sometimes you sort of shake it up. You're like, oh yeah, what if YouTube was a separate company and Google Search was a separate company and they spun out all those other bets? Like, what would that company look like?
Yeah. And when you talk about Uber and Instacart, it's really interesting because Uber sort of has become cash flow positive. You could imagine a world in which they could do some kind of deal. I don't know if they could. It would probably have to be in cash and stock. They don't have the cash to do something like this. I don't think. What is Instacart last valued at? Nor would they. But they did just offload Drizly, right? That was something, a startup that they bought for $1 billion, which probably isn't worth anywhere near that. But they're starting to sort of streamline. And grocery is kind of seen as, you know, the crown jewel of gig economy delivery because you've got bigger basket sizes. And DoorDash and Uber are both sort of locked in this race to try and do more in the grocery space. And Instacart has this presence already. So Uber, you could see a world in which this
both of them have the advertising business, the sort of like high margin advertising business that's been bolted onto the original business.
Was a copycat from Uber. Instacart's had that for longer, but agreed. It's things that Uber wants.
We just, you know, it's you just sort of have to underline that there was no news around this. This was just someone wrote a piece saying, hey, this is a possible reason to buy Instacart. What if it had a merger with Uber? But there's no actual reporting that any discussions have happened or anyone is even considering it.
And sometimes it's fun to speculate if there's a note that just makes you think. I'm looking at Instacart. Wow, it was up more than 6% today. And its market cap, $7 billion. That is... this is the company, I think at one point was worth somewhere around $40 billion.
Yeah.
So, you know,
in the private markets, I think it was valued at 39. That was its peak.
And something we've been talking about recently too is, you know, the possibility for more M&A strategics, private equity. But if valuations settle around here, we could see more of it. If not Uber and Instacart, maybe some other, especially in the software space. But we'll keep continuing this and we'll talk about the fun analyst notes as well here on our Tech Check podcast. Tune in tomorrow.
See ya.